This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There's been a lot of scrutiny on the EB-5 visa program since news broke of fraud allegations against NEK developers Ariel Quiros and Bill Stenger. They were using this foreign investor visa program to fund big development projects in the region, but federal and state charges allege that they were misusing these funds in what the SEC calls a Ponzi-like scheme. The visa program is a federal one that allows foreigners to put up $500,000 or $1 million in investment in a U.S. business in exchange for a green card. Some people have characterized it as buying a green card, but under the U.S. system, it's a perfectly legal and valid way to get a permanent resident card. But it's far from the only way. There are nearly 200 different types of visas that allow foreigners to visit, work, or live here. It's complicated, it's confusing, and it's not something we hear that much about in the immigration debate. So we're going to focus on all the different legal immigration routes today and hear from our guest about how well these programs work and what she thinks ought to change. I'm joined now by Leslie Holman, a Burlington-based immigration attorney. She's the past president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me back.
All right. So why do we have 185 different kinds of visas in this country?
Oh, well, they used to be characterized by letters, but we've run out of things to call them, so alphabet soup is no longer working.
Yeah, I mean, if you look down the list, they really are. It's like A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, O, P, on and on and on.
That's right, and the list continues, and they expand. And the problem is we've got many different options, but really, amazingly, not enough vehicles for what we need. And so we create more or visions, but still not enough.
But so 185 different kinds of visas. And for the purpose of this conversation, let's leave aside the visas that people get if they want to just visit to, you know, hang out with family here or go for a vacation in the U.S. and they're from a country that's not in the visa waiver program, because there are a lot of people who are coming in on visas to, like, pay a visit to the U.S. for a couple of weeks. So let's leave those visas aside. There are still a lot of visas that are given out and that are different kinds for people who want to work here, whether, you know, for several years or temporarily, or people who want to live here for various reasons. How would you sort of categorize the different visa types?
Sure. And, you know, I kind of think about having four branches or four ways to immigrate to the United States. You've got your business immigration. So if you've got a company that wants to petition for you, or a company needs an engineer from somewhere else, that's one venue. And something like the investor program would come under that business package, if you will. Then we have family-based immigration. And, you know, again, that's interesting. We've seen a real change in the nature of family-based immigration because of the internet. You know, someone who's sitting out in a foreign place like Derby, Vermont, may not, you know, may be working there for a large company that's got a base there. And all of a sudden, they're able to meet people. And that's actually changed that whole category of immigration.
You mean they meet somebody online who's from a different country and then form a romance and decide they want to get together?
Exactly.
Okay.
And then we've got your asylees and your refugees, and which are basically the same thing. The difference is where they apply from. A refugee applies from outside of the U.S. and asylee from within the United States. And then you have something called the diversity lottery, the diversity visa lottery, which was started to give people in countries who didn't really have a chance or didn't have as great a chance to enter the U.S. kind of you won the lottery.
And so you apply if you're from one of these countries, and if you're a lucky chosen one that fits within the quota, you get a visa?
There's no question. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do. There are certain minimal requirements. One is either a high school degree or enough experience that would equate with high school. There are countries that are not eligible, countries that really don't, you know, that have plenty, we think have plenty of people that have come here. I have some issues with it because in the last couple of years, it's online now only. And my feeling is, if you're looking to get people from countries, maybe third world countries, well, they don't have access to the internet often. You know, Conakry, Guinea will be out of electricity for 5 months. And that lottery system is very, very time driven and very exact. So I personally question whether the efficacy is really there.
On that particular category of visas, this lottery program, which, as you said, is supposed to allow for people who may be underrepresented in this country or from countries that we haven't taken a lot of immigrants from in the past for various reasons, Even that program, though, is fairly political in how it's come together, isn't it? Because some of it is countries that we either excluded people from in the past and maybe have to not make reparations, but, you know, it's sort of a way to say, all right, you know, we recognize that we excluded these people in the past, whether for ethnic reasons or not. But then, I mean, the last time I checked, isn't Ireland still in the lottery program?
Yeah, for Northern Ireland. I mean, there's different things. You know, it's funny, Jane, that you mentioned that because there hasn't been a whole lot of shape-shifting recently because I think it's a program that sort of gets put on the back burner more so. And I don't know the last time actually that they looked at those figures, but it would be very interesting.
So the majority of people who come in on visas to stay here for a significant amount of time and either work or live, is that the most visas we're seeing people who are, you know, coming in to immigrate here permanently or work here?
No, not really. You know, in terms of you mean non-immigrants, so that are just not looking to stay. Is that what?
Well, I mean, of all of the visas that are given out, which are the ones that are what are the biggest programs? I guess what are the biggest categories?
I would probably say family still. One, you've got your immediate relative, and there is no limit in number. So most categories, whether it be work or family based, you know, if you have a green card and you want to get your wife here or your husband. It could take 5 years, 6 years, because there's a limitation in numbers, which is absolutely insane. And, you know, you talked about visa categories. They created one to deal with that, and it doesn't work. Also, you know, marriage to a U.S. citizen, because it is the one that doesn't have numbers, is probably the one that ultimately does get used, that and family-based, the most. But that doesn't mean it's fraud. You know, I take the position because that always comes up. If people marry sooner than they might because there's all kinds of obstacles, that doesn't make it fraud if they're still involved in a relationship and there's no other mechanism.
I should say here, I am married to an immigrant and he came in on a K-1 visa, which is a fiancé visa. So we got married in the United States. You get 3 months after the foreigner comes into the country in which you have to get married. And then, you know, there are a lot of hoops that you have to jump through beforehand and even afterwards. And, you know, a lot of ways that the U.S. government tries to prevent fraud in cases like this. For example, I am financially responsible for my husband for 10 years after the start of our marriage, whether we stay together or not, whether he goes bankrupt or not. You know,
it can even be longer than the 10 years because I'm sorry to be the harbinger
Luckily,
of good or bad news.
We're together, so it's not a problem at this point. But
because if they choose not to work, because the 10 years is based on the person having worked for 40 working quarters, put in enough money. If they choose not to, there's a court decision in the last year that said, well, your spouse didn't want to work. You're no longer married, but you're still on the hook.
So do those mechanisms help prevent fraud? Because, you know, the marriage visa, you were at pains to point out it's not necessarily fraud if two people get married so that they can get this visa process rolling. But that is one category where people often think that there is a lot of fraud, people marrying for the visa rather than marrying for love or whatever other arrangement they have.
The love boat. Yes, but there is also people who are married less than 2 years and get a green card, they're considered a conditional resident. So one stopgap measure or fraud detection measure is, look, and it's an arbitrary figure that says after 2 years, if you're still not living together, you know, or rather, we're going to see you after 2 years and determine if it's still a valid relationship. And there are fraud things in place. I mean, I can tell you things they look at. You know, someone produces a lease for 1 year, 1 month, right before they need to file. There's things that will, you know, lead to, I think, the government looking for an indicia of fraud. But do I think that there is there's fraud in everything. There's people, you know, I always say, well, liken it to a bar. 18-year-olds get in. That doesn't mean we shut them down. And that's the same.
Well, unless we find out about it.
There we go. But not all bars. Maybe that bar.
Right.
But not – we don't get rid of public all bars. But, I mean, it's definitely an issue.
We're talking today about immigration, and we're looking specifically at legal means that people get into this country and how complicated it is. And listeners, if you'd like to weigh in on what you think works or what needs to be changed, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Maybe you have some experience with this, maybe on some sort of work visa. Maybe you work with people who are here on agricultural temporary worker visas. You can share your thoughts again, 1-800-639-2211. or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're talking with Leslie Holman, who's a Burlington-based immigration attorney, and you wanted to jump in there, Leslie.
Well, you know, it's so funny because immigration, there's never enough time to talk about things. But with regard to the fiancé visa that you lived through, how long did it take you?
From when we applied, it took about a year and a half.
And see, that is a huge problem. When people come to me and they say, look, I met the man of my dreams. I've got, 700 people coming to the wedding in 2 months. And they say, all right, how do I get my fiancé here? And I look and I say, oh, my God, Bridezilla. Because I routinely say to people, for a fiancé visa, minimum of 9 months. And yet you can't even plan because you don't know. And that's hard. It's really hard. And it's a long time to wait.
It's a long time. I highly recommend just eloping after that and, just go to the town hall. But anyway, and that's my story. Let's talk about some of the other types of visas. So we were talking about sometimes people want to come and work here. And there are many different kinds of visas for that. We're familiar in this state with temporary workers who come here often from Jamaica to pick apples. And they're here on a temporary agricultural visa. People may have been hearing the story a couple of years ago about the Burlington school superintendent who couldn't get a visa to come here from Canada. There are a lot of different ways that people come to work in this country. Can you lay out a couple of them, Leslie?
Gladly. And, part of the problem, if I'm going to start with the problem first, is while there are a lot of ways, they're not ways that we need because our system is so antiquated. And what I mean by that is probably the most common visa, something called the H-1B, which you referred to with the one for the Burlington School District.
That's a skilled worker visa. So
that's right.
Shorthand.
Skilled worker, however, is defined to be someone who has a bachelor's degree and is working in a job that requires a bachelor's degree. Now, it's called a skilled worker or professional position. Guess what? A nurse doesn't typically qualify because a bachelor's degree, nursing degrees typically are not 4 years. Hard to get an H-1B visa for a nurse.
And there used to be a specific visa for nurses when there was more of a nursing shortage here, but that's been folded into the H-1B program.
It has. And it's still easier, which is really odd, to get a green card for a nurse rather than an H-1B. But probably the H-1B is the most commonly used work-related visa. You've got an intra-company transferee visa, which is actually today the hardest to get. The government has really narrowed the focus of these. Therefore, they were started, you have a company in Canada. They've got a branch here. You should be able to transfer your managers and special knowledge people easily. I can give you the statistics. Probably 3/4, if not more, of those applications are given these extensive requests that it's almost impossible to get them here. And I just recently represented the head of development, research and development overseas for 22 years, coming in because there's a new branch. We had to jump through hoops to prove that this guy was really a manager and really needed to be here. We have visas for researchers and scholars. What we don't have are essential workers. And this is where we fall short. We don't have the people that – plenty of jobs don't require a bachelor's degree. You've got a guy who's an expert mold maker, but not so expert that he's the top of his field like, you bring Arnold Palmer in for golf. So that's really where –
which is a different kind of category altogether. You've got professional athletes who might win prize money. That's a different visa category even of itself.
And we see problems with that too because they say, well, you're not at the very top. Or we used to bring people in as coaches, because they just got an Olympic medal. And now they say, well, prove to us you're really a good coach, not just a good shot putter.
Yeah. But Leslie, I can hear people in my ear, in my mental ear here saying, boo-hoo, these are foreigners. We should be giving jobs to Americans. There should be more scrutiny for people who don't live in this country, don't have the rights of citizenship already. So why should we be worried about it taking a year? Maybe this company should just go hire some American who's qualified to do it instead.
It sounds great when you put that on paper and it sounds like a reasonable argument. But the truth of the matter is we don't have so many of the people that we need. And a lot of the money from the H-1B program is supposed to go into training. The system is so difficult that I could promise you if I brought my employers here, no one in their right mind would go through what they need to get these high-skilled workers or, these essential workers. And that's really where the problem lies. We don't have that, and it's needed. And for every job that someone fills, like, a job is created. So you've got people coming here and they still contribute to the economy. You've got their spouses, you've got their kids. And it really, it's a good snowball effect, not a bad one.
More on immigration coming up. We're looking at the legal system of immigration, how it works, how many different moving pieces there are, why it's so complicated. And I'd love your take, your input, your own story. You can call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. In the wake of the EB-5 scandal, we're learning more about the complicated system of legal immigration in this country. We're joined by Leslie Holman, a Burlington-based immigration attorney. And if you have a question about visas, we're talking H-2A, H-1B, K-1, F, even J, just give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Or post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And just for the record, those visas refer to seasonal agricultural labor, highly skilled labor, fiancé visas, student visas, and exchange visas. So again, our number, 1-800-639-2211. Leslie, you work with clients who are trying to get here or who are trying to get people here. Can you give us a story of one of them so that it helps personalize what we're talking about?
No question about it. And this really affects our state. I have a client who desperately needed a very skilled employee, something that required certification. And I will tell you that really they did something very important for many of the people in this state and relied upon. They had someone nearby in Canada across comes and applies for the job, is working for them. They go to get a green card. And they, when one gets a green card, unlike the H-1B, you need to show there's no U.S. workers to do the job, and that's another protection that I didn't mention. So you don't just typically get a green card. You have to show there aren't enough people.
Because a green card is a permanent residency card, and an H-1B is still considered a temporary residency permit that you're here for the duration of this job period, right? That's why there's a harder barrier to cross for the green card.
Exactly. For example, H-1B, you get a total of 6 years. So with this program, it is much harder, and the checks and balances in that regard are in place. Well, they tried to do it on their own, and it's so complicated, and they couldn't. And twice they didn't. They came to me. We filed their paperwork. We waited a year and a half in the system. We then get a question, which is called an audit from the Department of Labor, to make sure this job is really what it is and the person has what it is. And that we did all of the advertising. It's all done. Another year and a half. They get, you know what? We're not sure. So do us a favor. We're going to make you recruit again. They made them do this in 12 different online pieces.
The company.
You bet. They did it all. Because there's no one that applied that was capable. They had all the resumes. They finished it up. Government said, well, you know what? You're done. And we've never done this before, but advertise again. We did it again. 5 months later, their case was denied. And it was mind-boggling because they said one person was rejected because in their cover letter they said that they were qualified, but there was nothing in a resume to even indicate that they were. We just won it on appeal. I am thrilled for the company. It took them 6 years. Most companies don't want to do that.
Well, how can any company wait that long?
Well, one hopes it's a parallel track to an H-1B and you can keep an H-1B going. But typically, that's why you don't see the complaints, because people aren't going to do that. Just too long to get an employee.
If somebody comes in on a green card, then they have the ability to change jobs because they're a legal permanent resident who's here sort of independent of the company, right? So with an H-1B, what happens if you get laid off or if your job goes away or if you find a better job?
Yikes. That's another piece of our broken system. And people, you know, you hear about 11 million undocumented. And of course, everybody says, oh, my God, these are people that skip the border. They're all coming in droves. That's not true. Our system is so complicated that what happens is people fall out of status. H-1B, you walk in today and you go, you know, I'm sorry, we didn't get the contract. You're laid off. You're out of status that day. You may have children in school. You have a lease. Maybe you bought a house. You're done. And if you're in the process of getting a green card through that job, you're also done. So you're actually tied to, in most business-based immigration, you're tied to the person that petitioned for you, at least for the supposition is you're going to work for them. Indentured servitude, we got rid of mostly a while ago. So, you know, they can change later on, but the supposition is that you're going to work for that employer.
You're coming at this from a particular perspective of somebody who tries to work with these clients and work within the system and get it all to work. Given that, what do you think would work better? Because, you know, I don't get the sense that you necessarily think just open borders, open plan here. I mean, there has to be some way that this is done and some scrutiny by the government and some ability to set limits that a government has a right to do.
You know, I do. I think one of the things that's made things so difficult is in the wake of 9/11, they broke up what was the INS, remember them, and they created the Department of Homeland Security with different divisions. And all of them, for example, you'll have fraud looked at by each division. So things are taking so long because one's not talking to the other. That incongruity between the government pieces themselves is a problem. And that's something that needs to happen in reform and how that transparency will play out. Another piece, though, is we really need to look at our market. You know, the immigration system that was put in, that we follow today, doesn't take into account things like telecommuting. And that we need to overhaul the business system so that it reflects today's world.
Is that happening anywhere?
Yes and no. There are small baby steps. And I will say we do see things. You know, just recently we were told by the Department of Labor we no longer need to send a piece of mail by certified receipt return requested. Remember those? If someone applied for a job under this process where you're looking, if you didn't send that card, you failed the process. And yet half the time you get resumes today, they don't even have an address. So, you know, yes, we see pieces of it. Last November when the president said he was going to modernize the visa system, but it's slow and a bipartisan Congress doesn't help.
Let's go to Eunice, who's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Eunice. Go ahead. Eunice, are you there?
I am from South Burlington. Hi, Eunice.
Hi, Eunice. You need to turn down your radio. We're going to come back to you in just a moment. Turn down your radio and listen through the phone.
Jane,
go ahead.
Thank you so much for actually, launching this program about the immigration. There are so many. I have so many friends here in Vermont and abroad and in the country, and I just get so many questions. And because I have been here for 16 years, I am a naturalized U.S. citizen. I just actually, when I became a U.S. citizen, I petitioned for my brother in 2006. And then I am still waiting for him to come here. He was granted a visa and everything is working fine. The problem is that he's waiting, you know, that they are actually the backlog for actually petition for brothers and sisters, the fourth category. It is just like so behind. It's like 13 years behind. I just get like sometimes a bulletin and in my email, and they just started working actually on the files of 2003. So we are in 2016, and they are just, you know, they just started working on 2003, the files of 2003.
So Eunice, wow, what a situation. And thank you for explaining it to us. It sounds like Eunice applied for a petition for his brother to come over with him as a sponsor in 2006. And he's saying, Leslie, that it's such a backlog in the system for that kind of visa that they're only processing visa applications from 2003. Does that sound right to you?
Unfortunately, he's 100% correct. To petition for a brother or sister takes that long. And in fact, because of those backlogs, and it's just not happening, and there's so many problems. When they talk about moving chairs on the Titanic, you know, I think they need more visas, not just move them from one category to another. They talk about getting rid of that category because it's absurd. It's absolutely absurd that it would take that long.
But again, you can hear people saying, but why should his brother get to come here just because he's here?
Because one of the things that built us, and if I stand up here with my flag, you know, we value family. And, you know, so many people, you know, today need to be with their family. And that's what our country was founded upon, was uniting families.
I'm Jane Lindholm. You're listening to Vermont Edition here on VPR. Talking with Leslie Holman. She's a Burlington-based immigration attorney and past president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. We're talking today about legal immigration and the system as it stands now in the United States, how it works, and perhaps what doesn't work so well. We got a note from Tom, Leslie. Leslie, who says, I have worked at a ski resort for the last 8 years. Recently, I met someone from Argentina and started dating them. Problem is, their work visa expires in a month. We really like each other and would like to keep our relationship going, but we don't want to get married yet. Any suggestions on visas to look at?
It depends. You know, the interesting thing with immigration is it is all fact-based. So, you know, it depends on how, Tom, your girlfriend is here. Perhaps she has other options. Perhaps she has a bachelor's degree. There's a job that's there for her. But likely it's hard. Likely it's hard. And that is really something that we see.
So there's no way for somebody like Tom, except maybe, you know, pen pals or virtual pen pals at this point.
Right. Thank God for Skype. It's changed the, you know, but it's very hard. That's what you have to say. I'm so sorry. Which is why you end up seeing people get married sooner than they might. But that doesn't mean that it's fraud necessarily. It depends on what they're going to do with their life. I mean, we need, I think, a relationship visa. You know, even think about it. Your husband came in on a fiancé visa, which is a lot of what people end up doing. You know, 90 days is not a whole lot of time to either plan a marriage or, you know, people think I'm going to come here and see if it works out. You know, one would hope that people are on their best behavior in the first 90 days.
Yeah, I don't think you come in on a fiancé visa thinking, let's just check it out. Maybe it'll work and maybe it won't. You know, when there's something like the EB-5 fraud allegations that have just come out, and I want to make a point here that we're not talking about fraudulent foreign investors in this program. There's no indication that investors in this program, the foreigners who were giving $500,000 in exchange for a green card, were doing anything that was either wrong or fraudulent or misleading the system. The allegations are towards these developers who were taking that money and misrepresenting how they were spending it, you know, misrepresenting to the investors who basically have these unsecured loans. They don't have a way to guarantee a return on their investment, but are doing this in exchange for the visa, for the green card, rather. When there is an allegation of fraud like that, how does that affect other people who are looking for visas?
Oh, big time, you know, big time. Because, again, you know, and there's no question. Look, you know, our government has a hard job right now because, you know, security is also important. And I would never implicate that it is not and that we need these checks and balances. In the business context, though, every time there is a big fraud finding such as this, you get the restrictionists on the Hill. You get, you know, all of the people saying, see, this is why we shouldn't do this. But I point out the amount, the millions of people and programs that work. You know, we talk about ABC in the words of Michael Jackson, one bad apple doesn't spoil the whole bunch, girl. And those of us who practice business immigration think that the supposition of fraud in everything has really made legitimate immigration so hard. This will make it worse.
There was also a recent sting operation that the U.S. government organized to try to and to successfully sort of capture these student visa brokers who were helping others to obtain student visas. And that's a situation where maybe the visa holders themselves either should have known or did know they were doing something not quite right. There was a college set up in New Jersey that was a fake college. And so these people were getting visas for this college when, in fact, then they were going and getting jobs and working on their student visa, which they shouldn't have been doing. And this sting operation was set up and worked. Will that affect student visas, do you think? People who are trying to come in on student visas, will they get more scrutiny, maybe have a harder time getting to the college of their choice or the school of their choice?
I think actually, yes, but it's also going to make really more difficult changes in the student visa program itself, which will then ultimately trickle down. You know, we've seen a change in student visas since 9/11 because those two individuals were students, and then we've seen problems. And now the entire student program is actually overseen by ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, which is the police arm, if you will, in enforcement on this stuff. But there's absolutely no question.
Let's go to Lauren calling in from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hi, Lauren. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering how you can bring, if your family's overseas and they're in danger, they're refugees, basically, that had to flee their home. What are the methods or what are the ways to bring them to the United States? Is there a way?
Lauren, do you mean not through the asylum process or through the refugee process, but through some other visa?
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, basically. How does that work? I'm not sure.
Yeah. Lauren, thanks for the call. Leslie Holman. So there are these different avenues, the asylum process you mentioned, the refugee process, and then the family visa process.
That's right. The family based. Now, you know, again, we have immediate relatives. So, Lauren, if it was a husband or a child under 21, you would petition for them. And while it takes a while, maybe a year and 3 months, it's not limited in number. So they're always available. What happens is, depending on a relationship, if it's a niece or a cousin, there is no mechanism for that level of the of family relationship. You've got, you know, children under 21, children over 21, and then it's divided in marriage. But as you go down the familial chain, it gets more difficult and there may not be a way.
So we know that in the family visas, you said, for a direct relative, like a spouse or a child, that could take a year, a little bit more maybe. We hear often in the refugee program that it can take many, many years. And asylum is a little bit different, right, because you come to the country and claim asylum. So that's another way to at least get out of a country. But then you may be tied up in immigration proceedings through the asylum process for several years as well.
Exactly right. You know, you show up, and if you remember that movie with Mikhail Brezhnikov, the dance movie, I mean, that's what happens. They come to the United States, and then they, because they were able to get here, whether through a passport, whatever, they claim asylum, they get put into immigration proceedings. They're now overseen by the court, but they are here. And after a year, they can get a work authorization while the country is determining whether it's a valid asylum claim. A refugee, unfortunately, can be in a refugee camp in a place like Kinshasa for 10, 9, 7 years. And those camps are tough.
We got a comment from Nagi who says, I am an H-1B visa holder and currently working in Vermont. The most concerning item is green card date movement for EB-2 category. It's not moving. When a visa holder has family and kids, there should be a way to provide a green card in reasonable time, but definitely not more than 5 years. I absolutely respect and love this country and follow all the rules and have plans to live here till death, but still, there is no luck in getting a green card. Well, Leslie Holman, Burlington-based immigration attorney and past president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, thank you so much for walking us through just a little bit here of the visa process and some of the different ways that legal immigration works in this country. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. It's always fun to talk about this. Immigration lawyers are really social workers in disguise.
Coming up, there's a chance Vermont's out-of-state prisoners will need to move again. We'll talk with the corrections commissioner about potential changes in Michigan that could affect Vermont inmates there. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Some aspects of our culture are so ubiquitous that we don't stop to consider, how did this become a thing? Take, for instance, the piano. Our colleague, James Stewart, on VPR Classical, looks at the history of the piano in this episode of Timeline. It's a series that explores the development of Western music. And James starts off with a little Victor Borge, just for fun.
The modern piano is a masterpiece of acoustic design and engineering. It has 88 keys with the ability to play all of the notes a musician could possibly reach simultaneously, and a sound that can fill a concert hall by itself. Inside, the metal frame is holding 18 tons of tension as the strings are struck over and over again by large hammers. Each key triggers a complex mechanism, allowing the performer to easily control the volume of the note simply by touch. We see and hear the piano so often that we've forgotten just how unique an instrument this keyboard has become. Before the piano, the most prevalent keyboard instruments were clavichords and harpsichords. Clavichords were versatile, but very quiet, much too quiet to be played in an ensemble. The harpsichord was much louder and a favorite during the Baroque, but it had its own limitations. The nature of its design meant that it had only one dynamic. All the notes would sound at the same volume, regardless of the performer's touch. In 1698, the keeper of instruments at the Medici court in Florence, Bartolomeo Cristofori, began work on a new instrument that he called a harpsichord with loud and soft, or piano and forte. You would think the ability to create dynamics on such an instrument would be instantly popular, but the piano didn't take off during Cristofori's lifetime. In the 1730s, German manufacturers began to improve on the original design. J.S. Bach was even brought in as a consultant by one developer and eventually gave his endorsement of the hammer harpsichord. During the next century, the piano evolved in Germany, England, and France as each manufacturer tried their own take on the mechanics. However, it was the Viennese version that became the favored model of composers such as Beethoven, Schumann, and Brahms. The Romantics were constantly pushing the instrument's range and volume. Beethoven demanded so much from the piano that he would snap strings, splinter hammers, and even damage the frame itself. These musical demands made manufacturers invent new steel and iron framing with larger strings and heavier hammers. The next generation of composers, Chopin, Liszt, and Brahms, helped to cement the piano as the default keyboard instrument. Our modern piano is the result of a long period of experimentation, evolution, and innovation. So the next time you hear a child play chopsticks or perform a duet of heart and soul, remember all of the sweat, work, and time that made such an instrument possible.
That's VPR Classical host James Stewart with a little history of the piano from his series Timeline. You can podcast Timeline to learn more about the development of Western music. You'll find all the details at vpr.net. All of Vermont's current 236 out-of-state prison inmates are housed at the North Lake Correctional Facility in Baldwin, Michigan. They were moved there last summer. But a recent article by Mark Davis of 7 Days revealed that the contract with the GEO Group, the private company that operates that prison, could be voided. That's because the state of Michigan is considering closing two of its oldest prisons and leasing the entire Baldwin facility as an in-state prison. Here to tell us more about what might happen with the contract is Vermont's Department of Corrections Commissioner Lisa Menard. Commissioner Menard, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Jane.
What is the Michigan legislature considering exactly?
They are considering closing two of the Michigan Department of Corrections facilities and leasing the North Lake facility from the GEO Group. They would lease it, but staff it as if it were a state correctional facility.
Staff it as if it were a state correctional facility, and in terms of the inmates who could be there, just have in-state Michigan inmates?
That, I think, remains to be seen. First of all, if the legislation goes through, I've looked at it today, and what the actual amendment says, this is an amendment that was put in by a subcommittee. And what the amendment says is that Michigan will lease it from GEO and house any prisoners for whom the current owner is currently contracted if such an agreement is determined to be valuable to the department. And in this case, the department is the Michigan Department of Corrections.
Got it. So it would, though, I would think, void the GEO contract that Vermont currently has. And that is allowed in the contract between GEO and the state as long as there's 5-month notice. So you would have to renegotiate something at any rate.
That's correct, either with Michigan DOC or with GEO or with possibly even another party.
Have you talked with the Michigan Department of Corrections to see if there's any likelihood that keeping Vermont inmates in that prison would be in the best interest of the Michigan Department of Corrections, as stated in the bill?
I have. I've spoken with the commissioner, and she was, frankly, really noncommittal, appropriately. It's very early in the process for this amendment. I don't think she's really had an opportunity to fully gauge the impact that this would have on their department. Although I suspect if they're closing two facilities and leasing one facility, I don't know that they would have the capacity to continue to house us there.
So what are the options, Commissioner Menard, for Vermont if Vermont inmates in Michigan need to move?
There are a couple. One is to work with our current contractor, the GEO Group, to see if they can offer a placement in another facility that meets our needs. And if not, then to post a request for proposals for another out-of-state facility, just as we did about a year ago for this GEO facility.
How hard was it, though, to find the GEO facility and to get this contract going? I mean, would doing that be a big deal for the department?
Doing the contract is not the big deal. At this point, though, to be perfectly frank, we are not a big player in the out-of-state bed market. To Vermont, having 236 inmates out-of-state is huge. I mean, that's a big number for us. It's about, I guess, about a sixth of our total population. But if you think about, for example, Michigan, they have over 40,000 inmates. So Vermont, with 236 inmates, we're such a small player that it does make it more difficult to get somebody to bid and for the right dollar amount to offer the services and the housing needs that we prefer.
There are always questions about moving out-of-state prisoners back to Vermont. Is there any possibility that that could happen? I mean, 236 is a lot by our standards, but not a ton of prisoners, as you said, by many state standards, and certainly within the realm of possibility as that number keeps coming down to think about other ways that they maybe could stay in state.
Agreed. I would agree on that. 236 at this point, we still don't have the in-state capacity, despite this number being down from, 500 or 600 about, I'd say, 3 years ago. There still aren't 236 additional beds in state. That being said, there's a couple things at play right now. One is there's currently a construction project happening at the Springfield facility, and that has required us to take a unit offline, which is 50 beds. Once that project is completed, we would be able to bring 50 people back from out of state. That brings the number down significantly. And there's another conversation occurring right now in the legislature regarding the Caledonia Work Camp, and that conversation is around possibly repurposing it and allowing us to use half of it for non-work camp inmates. So that, again, would allow for another 50 inmates to be returned.
But that is a big question, because isn't that work camp supposed to be shut down in Governor Shumlin's budget?
That's correct. That's the governor's budget proposal. That being said, the House Committee on Corrections and Institutions put forth a change in the budget that they passed into the Senate, and that was to look at repurposing it. So that conversation, I believe, is alive right now.
Where do you stand on that? What would you like to see?
The reason it was recommended for closure were very sound reasons. They were that the facility is designated by statute as a work camp. We were not able to fill it as a work camp. Therefore, it made sense to look at closure. That being said, if the choice is to change the designation, it makes sense to fill the beds and to have the Vermont inmates in Vermont to the extent possible.
Commissioner Menard, if there is a need to move the inmates from Vermont who are currently in Michigan and they need to move to another prison, maybe another state, who will be responsible for the costs of moving them again? Because it does come with a cost.
It does indeed. That would very likely be part of any contract negotiation. And certainly if they went from one GEO facility to another GEO facility, that would be borne by the current contractor. If we bid with another contractor, another provider, that would be built into the contract that we negotiated with that provider.
And do you think this is likely to happen as we talk now? This is a bill moving through the Michigan legislature, but it's not something that's been approved and signed by the governor.
That's correct. It is basically, it's an amendment that was put in once the corrections budget moved over from the House to the Senate. So it's been through one subcommittee of the Senate, and it still has to go through the full Senate, same as the Vermont process from there. It'll go to conference committee if there's any issues that still need to be worked out. And I believe they go until June. So we still have some time to be keeping an eye on this.
Lisa Menard is Vermont's Corrections Commissioner. Thanks very much for talking with us about this issue.
Thanks, Jane.
And that does it for today. Now, four Vermont high school sophomores are using slam poetry to challenge stereotypes about Muslims. We'll talk with the students who call themselves Muslim Girls Making Change about poetry and identity tomorrow on Vermont Edition. Send your questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and be sure to tune in live at noon. Our producers are Sam Gale Rosen and Rick Singeri. We have production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.